pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Scott, a magnificent and consistent introduction yet again. Welcome, everybody. Episode 8, Iron Fist, Velvet Glove. Scott's with me, but I think Scott's angry this week. How are you feeling, Scott?
Look, Fist, I am angry. Angry at the stupidity of the last 24 hours, as well as just, you know, the foolishness of swimming against the tide, and just the blatant stupidity of what our Prime Minister has done. He has made himself look incredibly childish. And that's not even before you get me started on the fact that myself and my partner, as tax-paying, law-abiding citizens, are denied the right to say no to the Marriage Act. So, if you don't mind, gentle listeners, in the last 24 hours, Tony Abbott really has scraped the bottom of the barrel. He was confronted finally. And the thing about this that really upsets me is that every step of the way towards marriage equality, Mr. Abbott has put a new roadblock in the path. He said, once we achieve this, then that's fine, we'll bring it to a vote. So all the preconditions for this were laid out. It was a piece of legislation that had cross-party support so that, in his words, it could be owned by the parliament, not by a particular side. It was written and going to be introduced by a Liberal member, Warren Inch. All the ducks were in a row, and then he said, I'm going to invite the National Party in on this decision. So moderates within the Liberal Party have every right to feel ripped off today, because the Prime Minister has bussed in Rent-a-Tory via the National Party to stack the branch.
Rent-a-Tory,
that's exactly right. He's rolled them out. He has, in the words of Christopher Pyne, the same person that myself and the Fist have laughed about in the past, described it as an exercise in branch stacking, and he has got the result he wanted. Now, the Prime Minister is no stranger to, using that American term, playing hardball and getting what he wants. But he's never used his weapons on his own side like this.
Yes.
Now, why I think it was incredibly churlish was that, frankly, let's face it, in the political bubble that is the Parliamentary Liberal Party, there probably weren't the numbers there to have a conscious vote anyway. And secondly, even if they did get the numbers up for a conscience vote, there, more importantly, there probably weren't the numbers on the floor of the House to get the damn thing up anyway.
Really?
So what he's done is he's... Oh, yeah.
What, with Labor? Labor and conscience votes from Liberals?
It's close. It's close, because you've still got to remember you've still got Labor members that would also vote against it. It's a lot closer if you had a conscience vote from the government.
So just to be...
not guaranteed.
Just to give everybody a bit of background, with this, normally you'd expect the Liberal Party parliamentarians to meet and decide whether they're going to allow a conscience vote or whether they're going to vote as a block. And what Tony Abbott did was he brought the National Party into that meeting, with the National Party fellows being much more likely to be anti-gay marriage and therefore vote in accordance with his wishes. So he brought them into what you would normally expect to be a Liberal Party meeting to shore up his numbers.
Hmm. And that's what was most offensive about it all, was that he brought in outsiders to to do his dirty work for him.
The Rent-a-Tories.
Rent-a-Tory. Yeah, he brought in the Rent-a-Tories. And, you know, as Christopher Pyne said, stacked the branch, got the result he wanted. What's the end of that? What's the final analysis of that is, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, marriage equality is as dead as the dodo in this parliamentary term.
Yes.
But now we take that. So that's the original wound.
Mm.
Now let's go apply the salt to it.
Oh, okay.
He's decided that the best thing to do would be to allow the clown car that is the Australian Christian lobby, with intellects like Reverend Fred Nile and Wendy What's-Her-Name from the ACL, they'll be able to go out there at some stage, at some future date, and have a campaign against marriage equality. So in Australia, where we have been reasonably good at keeping God and the Bible out of political campaigns, we're going to now have a vote, which frankly is unnecessary. It was a couple of months ago when the Irish had their vote, Tony Abbott said, no, this is a matter for the Parliament. And now he's decided that, no, it's a matter for the people. And so we're going to have a situation where something that should have been very easy to solve, very simple, so that we could have lined up with such rogue, irregular nations like the United Kingdom, the United States, the Republic of France, Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Sweden, you know, rogue countries like Canada and New Zealand, for example, that we might have been able to have a marriage equality bill passed by the Parliament, then we can move on to the more complicated issues. But no, to get to this plebiscite so that Wendy What's-Her-Name and Fred Nile can call me an abomination in public, we've got to re-elect the Abbott government, and then at some future date, he'll announce the date of this plebiscite. If he's determined on having this public vote, why don't we kill two birds with one stone and have the plebiscite at the same date of the election at some stage next year? But clearly he wants to drag the whole thing out, and it's not just me saying that. Malcolm Turnbull said today that the whole issue is now going to be dragged out into the future, which is completely unnecessary. So I do feel somewhat miffed this evening.
Rightly so.
Over to you.
Rightly so. I mean, he's just kiboshed it, and he said, you know, basically he's assuming he'll be elected at the next election and at some stage during...
But let's face it, Fist, even atheists are praying that doesn't happen.
So we'll actually make the next election a bit of a... It'll be a big factor in the election, I would have thought. And if he wasn't going to lose the election already, then I think... that's going to help turn even more people against him.
Well, I think that's right in that, you know, now look, the pundits are accurate when they say, look, this is not a vote-changing issue. But when you take it in totality, if you look at the last 6 months of this government, and then this is the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, if you add everything up that they've done that has been mishandled, that has been so appallingly done, and it's all got his bloody fingerprints on it, you know, then it becomes a vote changer. Right now, yeah, in isolation, knighting Prince Philip is not a vote changer. But you add all those things up together, and then you've got the view of an incompetent government. Anyway.
Well, what I'm going to do now is play part of an interview which I found on the Guardian website with Tony Abbott, with what he had to say about why he's doing it. And then we can talk a little bit after that. So here he is.
Do not underestimate the magnitude of this as a cultural shift. Never before in this country or anywhere until very recently has this been regarded as an appropriate cultural norm. Now, I'm not saying that we will never change. Obviously, the fact that we are disposed to put it to the people in the next term of Parliament shows that we are open to change, but please, let's not underestimate the magnitude of this as a cultural shift. This is an issue which is so personal, on which people feel so deeply, so strongly, in many cases. Why not let the people, rather than the Parliament, decide this? That's the democratic and the fair thing to do.
So, essentially, he's saying there that... it's not the cultural norm, so in these sorts of situations, we should put it to the people for a vote. And my take...
I have...
Go ahead.
No, I have... I'm just... Before I get accused of... not by yourself, but anybody that might be listening to this saying that I've got sour grapes, I have no doubt the plebiscite will be won by those in favour of marriage equality, but it is going to be a very bruising encounter.
Yep.
Where you are going to be able to have religious bigots come out and say the most outrageous things, and because you're no longer able to criticise people on the basis of their religious faith, they're going to be able to get away with it and not be questioned because they're going to hold up a magic book and say, God said.
Yes. Yeah. So, anyway. But, you know, this whole notion that if something is against a long, standing cultural norm, then you have to have some sort of referendum in order to pass a law. Well, my goodness, we're going to have referendums every second week.
Tax reform, climate action,
you know,
there's a whole range of things.
I seem to recall that it wasn't a cultural norm to have religious chaplains in our state schools. Like, that had never been done before, introducing religion into our secular education system. Don't remember. Did I miss it? I don't remember any plebiscite or referendum about that.
No, because, and the original point of state education was clearly stated at the time by the founders, it is to be universal, free, and secular.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's such a two... This is part of this. I learned a word the other day was sophistry, which was sort of making an argument which was clever but false. It's kind of like with the boat people, where they're saying, oh, we don't want boat people to be killed, therefore we won't let them on the boats and drown in the sea. Meanwhile, of course, you know, they're dying in their thousands back on land and where they're stranded. So the sort of, oh, we're concerned with their welfare, therefore we don't want them on the boats because they might get hurt. Just a clever argument that isn't the real reason. And, you know, the same with this. It's a clever argument, but it's not his real reason because it's so inconsistent with what normally happens. And
exactly.
I just wanted to make the point, you know, like, okay, so what? Big decisions now we're going to put to the Australian people? Well, how about whether we go to war or not with another country? Like, at the moment, and there's a link in our show notes to an article by Malcolm Fraser, where he was lamenting our relationship with the United States in terms of defence and how we're basically so heavily attached to them and arguing that we shouldn't be. And he was saying that in many other democratic countries, including the United States, the basic authority to declare war or stay at peace rests with the Parliament. It is essential and urgent in Australia that the power to declare war or to stay at peace be transferred from the Prime Minister to the Australian Parliament. Well, based on what Tony Abbott's just said, you know, cultural norms, I mean, it wasn't a cultural norm for Australia to be at war with Iraq. Don't remember any plebiscite about that. I mean, are you wanting to give up some powers in that regard? It just...
I mean, prior to that first Iraq war, Iraq was one of our best wheat customers.
Yes. So
this, it was not really in our national interest to invade them.
So this whole notion that, cultural norm, need to go to a plebiscite, give me a break, we'll be there every second week, and you're not going to do it on something as important as whether we go to war with a country or not. So, you know, on this sort of, in the scheme of things, relatively minor issue, just don't believe you. You're talking rubbish yet again, and people can see through you, Tony Abbott. So that's sort of one take on what he said. And while we're sort of on this topic of gay marriage, you alerted me to a fellow who's made some comments. Do you want to talk about this character at all?
I think we should at this time, because we are talking about bizarre religious statements.
Yes.
Perhaps it's time to resurrect the "you can't be curious"
moment. Oh yes, you can't be curious. So
yes,
listeners will remember that with Nick Kyrgios and his antics, I did introduce a segment called "You Cannot Be Kyrgios," and it's kind of fell by the wayside. But we're figuring this is the time to resurrect it. And given that today was a public holiday in Brisbane, I did have the chance, listeners, to do a little bit of audio. So when somebody does something a bit madcap, usually from a right-wing Christian perspective, where we say you cannot be serious, I think we might just play this little intro for them. So
you can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
So thank you, John McEnroe, for that introduction, and go ahead with our submission for the "you cannot be curious" moment this week.
And This gentleman is, I've just got to go back to my original email so I can give you his name. Peter
Kentley.
Kentley, that's yes. Right. Now, he was from, I forget which Christian lobby group. It wasn't the ACL.
You keep talking, I'll come up with it. I've got it here somewhere. Yeah.
Okay, now he was...
he's the executive director of the Pentecostal group called Christian Federation. There you go. Does that sound dangerous to you? The executive director of the Pentecostal group Christian Federation? Immediately my alarm bells start ringing.
Well, I mean, you would think that he was, you know, if he was in certain parts of the United States, he'd be worried about his congregation being armed.
Yes.
But, you know, at least over here we can keep automatic weapons out of the hands of lunatics. Anyway, Peter Kentley organised a peaceful protest this week where he wanted all the supporters of maintaining discrimination in the law to send bunches of flowers to the Parliament House addressed to Tony Abbott to thank him for his leadership on this particular issue. So he then fronted up on AM, Radio National Breakfast,
yeah,
with Fran Kelly on Monday, I think it was, yeah, when I was listening to it at the gym, and I had to laugh.
Yeah.
Have you got the audio
there?
Yeah, I've
got a bit of the audio, so let me grab that.
Let the listeners listen to him, and they can make a decision about what they think about this gentleman.
Yeah, okay. So I'll play the first part. Okay, here he goes.
Sure.
Do you understand that that's as insulting as being called a bigot?
Well, I think we'd have to do statistical analysis and look at the experience from other countries such as Canada, and look at the outcomes and look at it scientifically and rationally and draw rational conclusions. I mean, from our point of view and from a Christian point of view, it's our duty to honour people, to treat them with respect and goodwill. And I hope that that's the way we can all speak to each other.
So, Scott, that, you know, rationalism...
quite reasonable, doesn't it?
Sounds,
yeah, I mean, but... seeing he's brought up the rational point of view and looking at the actual science of a homosexual couple raising children, there is a fair amount of research actually out there already. But this is one point that I think a lot of people have overlooked, was that more than one, and this is from the ABC on their fact check, it's from a... which will be up on the website, Fact or Fiction, A Mother and Father is Better Than Same-Sex Parents. Pathway down, more than 100 studies have compared the outcomes of children from same-sex and heterosexual parents. US study, randomly, la-da-da, where is it? Of the 10 outcomes studying, including indicators like warmth they felt for their parents, was that the children of same-sex parents felt more connected at school. So they've got better education outcomes.
Yep.
Now, we go down further, there was even better...
But basically, better there's been 100 studies and other studies that have looked at some of those studies, and the conclusion from them is that same-sex couples do a great job of raising children.
And that's what the conclusion is,
yep.
Yeah. So that's his first point. Okay, fair enough. Peter, where do we go from
here? Well, yeah, so he calls for, you know, a rational look at these things, and clearly he hasn't bothered Googling because you can find 100 studies on the outcome if you wanted to. But, you know, he seems a reasonable guy, but something about, you know, the executive director of a Pentecostal church has me worried, Scott. So here's a little bit more information that people might find interesting. Hang on.
You tweeted, I think last month, that Lucifer is embarking on a, quote, global and systematic long-term strategy to sever the relationship. You're talking about marriage there. Isn't it uncivil to say same-sex marriage supporters are doing the devil's work?
I'm not talking about humans in that regard. I'm talking about the spiritual dimension of this on a global basis, and it's an overall global observation which many people are able to make.
Lucifer. Haven't heard that word in a while, Scott.
I had no idea he was present in my life. So I am doing the devil's work, apparently. So.
Well, he doesn't want to criticise individuals. You know, he's talking to a spiritual level there, that Lucifer's doing that. But he didn't want to say that people are doing the devil's work. You know, wouldn't want to offend people. But Lucifer is out there doing this sort of stuff. So,
but forgive me if I'm wrong. I grew up in a Christian background, and we were always taught that, you know, the devil would be vanquished by God and Jesus anyway in the end time. So are they really that scared of this guy that's supposed to be weaker? Well, but that's by the by. I'm not going to get into theological arguments because it's all a load of nonsense anyway.
Yeah. Shows how, you know, kind of clever these people are where they talk about, oh, let's look at the statistics, the facts. Let's treat it in a rational basis. Where's the science? Blah, blah, blah. Not realizing that there is 100 studies already confirming that his problems are ill-founded, you know, his concerns are ill-founded. And yet, in the same breath, these same people can talk about, you know, Lucifer undertaking sinful work throughout the world in a spiritual sense. Like, this is, like, he's on Nate Radio. He wasn't on some community radio station, you know, at Claremont in regional Queensland. He was on Radio National. Like, this is what gets me about the run that the religious people get on mainstream media. Where was the did Fran Kelly ring the secular party and say, got a religious nutter here, do you want to provide a counter argument? No. Like, where's the balance?
Well, yeah, and that's a reasonable point. I mean, I suppose being a long-term listener to AM, they don't often put on a... it's not often you have two callers going out at hammer and tongs. Frankly, I think it would actually benefit the whole debate if there were two people arguing the, you know, counterpoints. But the point that was raised a couple of weeks ago by yourself about religious privilege, when you can have someone come on radio and talk about the Dark Prince as if he is actually real and was sighted last month at Myers, it's just absurd.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I think Christopher Hitchens, you know, watching, you know, the late, great Christopher Hitchens, when you watch and listen to some of his debates that he had throughout his time, he said, sure, I can never completely disprove the existence or non-existence of a God in exactly the same way you can't do the opposite.
Yeah.
And yet this clown's allowed to go on Radio National and speak as if, you know, well, Trevor, didn't you know Lucifer's out there?
Exactly.
You know, he's out there doing this work as if it's some sort of fundamental truth.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way the sky is blue, well, the Lucifer's at work here trying to get same-sex marriage up. It's just madness.
It is.
Anyway.
But anyway, we've resurrected our You Cannot Be Curious moment, and to Peter Kentley of the Pentecostal Church that he's the chief executive of, I think we'll play this little snap just as our feelings towards you this week.
I'm going to award a point against you, Mr. McEnroe.
So that's gay marriage and You Cannot Be Kyrios. And that leads me in, because I did have a little bit of a rant towards the end there, Scott, with, you know, again, the free run, Radio National gives this guy some voice. And I'll just make a little diversion here on our Secular Party Facebook page. I've managed to hand that over to Karen, who's sort of taking charge of that at the moment. And that's good on a couple of fronts. A, it frees up time for me. And B, when she makes a post and some of our followers make some crazy comments, then I can, at a personal level, in my guise of the Iron Fist, launch into the debate battle and make a few blunt comments if I feel like it, which I felt like I couldn't do before. If I'd kind of made the post, I couldn't really defend it under another hat. So anyway, what we had during the this week was I posted on Facebook a thing to say, you know, there's these 8 religious programs on ABC which are either pro-religious or very sympathetic to religion, and noted that there wasn't any secular or atheist programs to counteract that narrative. And that's what I said. I actually didn't even say we should have such a program. a secular program, but I guess by implication I said it, which is fine. And I'm really surprised by the number of people who said, well, we've got science programs on the ABC, we've got Compass, and we've got science documentaries, and they're secular, so that's good enough. And I'm really shocked by that, because I, you know, launched into the Facebook page and made some sort of further comments, but you've got eight programs that are pro-religion. They're spruiking the fact that religion's acceptable, it's valid, it's all good, it's doing great stuff, it's a legitimate thought process, blah, blah, blah. A science documentary on lions in Africa doesn't counteract that narrative, and we need a dedicated program that actually stops and looks at the week's events, much like this podcast, and says, hang on a minute, not everybody thinks that. That's a load of rubbish from a secular point of view. And I don't know, Scott, you thought, I don't know, you weren't as surprised as me.
I've got to admit, I wasn't as surprised as you. I mean, I can understand there was one comment there. I won't use any of the names, so if you are listening to it, don't worry. We won't be dropping you in it. But there was one comment that did say, I'm just trying to find it. I apologise, I'm so slack. Being fair, the ABC is supposed to be representing of the entire community, was one comment.
Yes.
Which I thought was a reasonable argument to put forward.
But hang on, a significant proportion of the community, possibly 50%.
Yeah, I know. We're then talking about under 50%. Yeah, good point. Yeah, okay, that's a fair enough. That's a fair enough argument. Where are we?
This is why I'm the Iron Fist. And yeah, Scott is the Velvet
and
Glove.
That is a reasonable performer. And if we do actually get whoever is pushing to change the religious question in next year's census, then we'll get some real accurate numbers about what people actually believe.
Yeah.
You know, rather than the assumption being you've got a religion, just tell us what it is. They'll actually ask the question, do you have one?
Quick backgrounder on that. Have we mentioned this in the past on the podcast?
I thought we may have done, but maybe not if we got to give a background. But go for it. You probably know more about it than I do.
Very briefly, our census question says, basically, which religion are you? And then it lists a bunch of the major religions and then has, you know, I'll tick the box for other. And then very last of all says, you know, none. So that's how it has been framed. And as a result, about the none figure has been increasing dramatically over recent census surveys, up to 22%. But in New Zealand, they ask the question, A, are you religious, yes or no? And if you tick no, then you stop. And if you tick yes, you can then nominate which religion. And
which is a lot fairer.
Exactly. And they're up to 42% as non-religious simply by the way that the question is framed. And if you look at other surveys that have been conducted by various polling groups, when they ask people whether they are religious or not, the figures are in the 50% figure for non-religious. So it'll be interesting to see what happens at the next census. The question of religion was the most hotly debated. It received the most correspondence. It was by a long way. So it'll be interesting to see what the Bureau of Statistics does with that question in the 2016 census. But anyway, so I digress. When I said, you know, to counter that argument, you've got eight shows that promote religion, yet quite possibly and most probably 50% of the population are not religious.
Yeah, so then I think that comes down to a fundamental... for me, it's a question of does your definition of secularism, is it a fairly simple one like my own, saying that, you know, we just want the state and people's religious beliefs to be entirely separate, or do you want to go further and say, well, we should also then use the state to promote, for want of a better term, an atheist agenda? So, hence why I'm more than comfortable to have shows that debate each other.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little uncomfortable with you if you then had programming that was, shall we call it, anti-religious. That Like, I mean, I love the fact that you have documentaries that basically come out and say that evolution is a truth, you know, that it's not a hotly contested idea, that it is, this is how we evolved, not this is how scientists believe this happened. It's presented as a truth. So to my way of thinking, that line of argument, hence why the gentleman who responded pointing out the catalyst and that sort of stuff, I think he did have a reasonable point in that there was a secular angle to some of the broadcasting that is on the national broadcaster. So, you know, like I said, it's just a slightly different point of view than what you would have, I would imagine.
Look, but, you know, I'm not calling for a program that blasts all religions. I would just want one that blasts certain features of certain religions. I mean, not much, just the sexual abuse, the seal of the confessional, the Ellis defense, the way it divides the community into groups, causing sectarian violence, the way it promotes primitive morality and blocks social policy progress, the fact that it promotes faith, drains the public purse of tax dollars, the rapture encourages short-term thinking. It's just a few odd things like that that, you know, I don't want to have to criticise the whole of religion, but just pick a few bits and pieces.
Well, you know, I mean, you can achieve a lot of that with a fact-based, you know, history is one of the things I would, you know, I wish it paid more because that's something I would have studied. Mm. But looking back at what has been achieved since Europe got the church out of its government, you know, looking back at what the United States achieved when science and reason was looked at as something wonderful and something to be proud of, as opposed to now where you belittle it and you've actually got some people like that. No, there was even a bloody billboard outside an American church that did the rounds on Facebook where it said, the more educated you get, the further you get away from God. You know, so I can understand.
It says the more educated you get, the further you get away from God, and it promoted that as a bad thing, did it? Yes. Oh, right. Okay.
It did. It promoted that as saying that education was a bad thing because it drives you away from God.
See, that's a useful sign because the religious and the non-religious could both use the same sign.
You could easily turn it around. You could easily turn it around saying, you know, by getting educated, you no longer need the nonsense that's in the
book. Yes.
You know, so, yeah. But it's, I think that that'd be, if we have a program director from the ABC listening to us, that'd be something the Velvet Glove would like to see as a historical documentary on how much better things were once secularism was introduced as a reasonable concept within the government.
Yes.
So, you know, there are those angles you could take, which aren't openly attacking religion, but they do show what happens when you allow a society to question something that used to be held as a fundamental truth that couldn't possibly be attacked.
That's right. Like, you could do things like look at Sweden, where everybody is educated in a government school. There is no religious indoctrination, but there is religious education. People are schooled as to the different beliefs of the different faiths. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that people need to know, that, hang on a minute, the Australian system of 30% of schools are private, educating 40% of children into a religious faith is highly unusual, and people don't know these things until they're told. And a documentary on lions in Africa doesn't tell you that stuff. So, as I said on the Facebook page,
no, but
a documentary is as secular as a loaf of bread.
Well, I would say it is secular in that it's non-religious.
Yeah.
So,
but that's a cop-out. So,
I don't think it's a cop-out. I think that if you take the different definition, then you're going to find yourself getting involved in theological arguments, which are pointless. I mean, it's like that ridiculous debate that the Catholic Church had once back in the 1600s about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. It's just a nonsense argument to have. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I would be mindful of attacking them directly for what they believe in, because I think you then end up arguing about how many angels can dance.
You know what?
I'm
not interested in converting people to atheism. Couldn't care less. Like, that argument bores me, that whole prove there is no God type argument. It's just, it's got nothing for me. But no, I'm certainly ready, willing, and able to argue against the actual ideas of misogyny and all these sorts of things that come up. So that's where we need to address those sorts of issues.
Agreed. Now, if I can just get on my other hobby horse for a moment, the SRE program in New South Wales.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure you've got on the reading list the Sydney Morning Herald article.
Yes.
Where those brave souls from Fairness in Religions in Schools are pushing back against the nonsense that's being spread to innocent children.
Yep.
And how's this for a good little piece of child abuse? This is from page...
We'll just tell people what they're doing.
48. I apologise. With the SRE program, which is Special Religious Education in State Schools, you used to be able to say, do you want to go to an SRE program or do you want your kids to go to a secular ethics class? That option of secular ethics class is now going to be hidden from view so that people will be more inclined just to think there's only one option. They'll tick that box and then their kids will go off and learn pearls of wisdom about the Christian faith. One of which comes from page 48, chapter 12 of the Anglican special religious education program. So not even your real nutty churches, but one of the more moderate ones, where it says, God says you are stuck in your sin and need to be rescued from his judgment. How do you like that bit of child abuse there, Fist?
It's typical. And, you know, and a documentary on lions in Africa doesn't address that. That's what I think about.
No, but a documentary or a current affairs investigative piece on the SRE program does address it.
Exactly. So what Firis has done is they've crowdfunded a billboard to say, did you know your child signed up for this? And then they've got that quote in there. So it's basically trying to alert people this is the sort of thing that's going on. So, and there's a billboard in Sydney. So good on them.
Yeah, absolutely good on them. And, you know, because this is the thing, one of the things that you and I've said before on numerous occasions is that the perception is that religions, it's benign. You know, it's not hurting anyone. Well, this is telling kids that they are stuck and that, you know, they're hopeless and lost and everything else, which is just absurd.
Yep.
You know, because they're at the beginning of their life. They've got the whole thing ahead of them, and then you're already turning around and telling them they're broken. I find that distasteful. But if we can just, you know, sing the praises of one gentleman from the Theos. This is a gentleman from, where was he from? Rod Bauer, who is famous for Facebook photos from outside the Gosford Anglican Church, which you may or may not have seen. Right. He said, SRE classes should be replaced by a quality general religious education program in public schools to reflect this multicultural, multi-faith society. Now, what have you been calling for recently?
Exactly that. Religious education class to put standard. But you're saying this is a theist who has proposed
this? Is a gentleman who's from the Anglican Church, from the Gosford Anglican Church, and he often changes the sort of billboards they have at the front of churches with those removable letters, and they put, you know, Jesus wants to be your friend and that sort of stuff on them.
Yep.
Well, he's famous for putting up fairly controversial stuff about asylum seekers and all that sort of stuff in a positive way. And also he's entered into the gay marriage debate and so on and so forth, where he's basically taken a position that is often contrary to what the Australian Christian lobby would be asking him to do.
Yeah, you know what?
So he's...
Sorry, go on.
No, he's just a moderate theist.
Yeah, you know...
That's it, the likes of which you should listen to. But
it doesn't surprise me that much that he's from the traditional section of the Christian church.
Absolutely.
It's the evangelicals who are the ones pushing for these things. So I've had discussions with different people involved in religious instruction courses, and they kind of admit, what's the point in doing this if we really should be doing it in a generalist sort of talk about all religions sort of fashion? It's only if you're going to really proselytize heavily that you would commit the man hours and the money to doing it. And that's what the Pentecostal churches are prepared to do. So the more traditional Uniting Church, Anglican, etc., are probably more likely to opt for general religious education as opposed to indoctrination.
Exactly.
So,
and you know, I mean, but as part of that general religious education, the kids would be able to then critically think and evaluate whatever's put in front of their face and think to themselves, you know, this is just nonsense.
Yep.
And on the topic of nonsense, a bloke who was in favour of the SRE, the Anglican Bishop of South Sydney and Chairman of the Sydney Diocese SRE Task Force, Rob Forsyth, said, if these parents don't like it, no one is forcing their child to attend SRE classes. They don't have to go. It's as simple as that. But they should not be trying to stop other people from sending their kids to SRE if that's their choice. Yeah, but the problem is, sir, you have hidden the choice.
Well, you've hidden the choice.
The enrolment forms. Yeah.
But it's also, you're conducting it in a government school. Like, do it outside of school, at church.
Agreed.
You don't have to do it in a government school. And there's plenty of time for kids to learn about religion at Sunday school and on Sundays, if that's what you want to do. Mm-hmm. But you have no business being in a government school.
If you want to introduce your children to such horrific topics as original sin and tell them they're broken, that's your stupid business. It's got nothing to do with the taxpayer. Yeah.
So, you know, we don't allow creationism. We don't allow creationism over evolution, and so we shouldn't allow this nonsense into our government schools either. So,
no. I mean, if parents want their kids to learn that faith and that sort of stuff, that's something that they have to teach themselves or they have to make arrangements for themselves. I don't see why our public assets should be used and valuable teaching time be taken up for it.
Well, now we're coming back more into line together, Glove, so that's a good thing. So next up...
Like I said to you, there are only modest differences. Go on.
Next up, I mean, you know, we started off with this podcast saying that, you know, I had a bit of a soft spot for Noel Pearson. And, you know, that generally I kind of like the guy. And he was a bit of a criticism, but I still like him. And he was another criticism, but I still like him and blah, blah, blah. But he's crossed the line again. And
well, this one is a what the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is probably another candidate for You Cannot Beat Kyrgios. Well, I think it's worthy of it. Hang on a second. Here we go.
It's worthy? Yeah. So you're going to nominate him for the eventual prize?
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Yes.
The distressing part is apparently he is serious.
He is serious. What's he done? That's what people are asking. And I've got an article here, and I've said this before. It's part of what I'm doing with all the secular stuff. For my sins, I have signed up to a newsletter from the Bible Society, and you occasionally get through a gem like this one, which Noel Pearson says living languages need the Bible. Noel Pearson accepted an invitation to speak at Wycliffe Australia's recent conference in celebration of 60 years of work, and it was all about reading from the Bible in the native Aboriginal language that Noel grew up with, and I apologise for my pronunciation. It's GWGUYIMITHIR, Guyugu Yimithir community, something like that. So, anyway, Noel has got a bit of a soft spot for his native language. Good on you, Noel. But at the same time, a soft spot for the Bible, and that's where Noel and I to part ways yet again. And just reading from the article, nevertheless, Pearson yearns for the day when the New Testament is fully translated into Guyugu Yimithir. The advent of a Guyugu Yimithir Bible is something that is still a matter of great anxiety to me and the people of my community. I really think that I will feel reassured about the future of Guyugu Yimithir when we have a full translation of the New Testament. I really think that the work that has been done on New Testament translations around Australia is just the most important work. This is quoting Noel Pearson. And further on, around the room, Noel gave an intermittent translation back into English from Romans chapter 8. So this is important to Noel, that this sort of stuff is translated into his native language. I mean, I agree with him at one point. He says that it's a matter of great anxiety to him. Well, no, it's a matter of great anxiety to me as well, but for different reasons.
Especially the work in Romans. Very angry.
Well, then at this gathering, he's intermittently translating back into English. Jesus Christ tells us God really loves us. He gave us his son to die for us. He gave us his son freely. He cleansed us. Jesus Christ died for us. He's pleading with his father for us. He loves us. Who can separate us from his love? No way, nothing. We might have trouble. We might be sick. They might be talking bad about us. They might have anger towards us. We might be poor and hungry. They might want to kill us. He's steadfast with us. God will never leave us. This is the sort of tripe that Noel Pearson thinks is important to be translated into a native Aboriginal language. I mean, this is the last thing that Aboriginal communities need. I mean, this whole notion that faith, it rejects reason, and Aboriginal communities need reason. It ties morality to pleasing God rather than getting on with real life here on earth. And it's this notion of, don't worry, suffer now, because you can go to heaven later. Like,
see, that is the thing that really sickens me about the revealed religions, where you have this idea that you just accept your lot in life because it's all part of a larger plan and the rewards come later. It's just it's no way, you know, and this is the only thing that Karl Marx wrote that I probably agree with, is where he said that it is the opium of the people, because it just dulls the senses, makes you just follow along like sheep and put up with the crap that the ruling classes, which used to be the church, shoved down on you.
Yes.
And for a man like Pearson to actually say that's what his people desperately need.
Yes.
I don't know. His people desperately need to find their place in this society and stand up for themselves and not allow themselves to be treated like victims.
Yes.
And I think particularly that bit that he has quoted from Romans, all it does is it's a call for them to be subjugated.
Yep. It's a terrible thing.
Very poor form, Noel. Very poor form.
Look, I might have got it wrong in there. It might have been he read from a translation to his mother's language of Kuku Yalangji. You know, it's a bit difficult to follow this article in terms of the language, but, you know, the point is exactly the same. And I think he grew up on some sort of mission as well, which might have brainwashed him into this thinking. But that is, I mean, he calls for Aboriginals to sort of pull themselves up by their bootstraps a bit. But then when you introduce this sort of thinking into the equation, you are just ruining all the good work.
Absolutely. And just you're saying to people, accept your lot in life because your reward's coming later. Well, you know, we've definitely got one life because I'm living it. So, you know, I'm not going to give up on that one life for the possibility of one after.
So
really awful. Yep.
So, look, we've got a biggish topic. Saudi Arabia, I reckon we might carry that over to next week, because I'm kind of conscious of trying to keep these down to 60 minutes.
Oh, gee, we are getting up there, aren't we? Yeah. And that is a big one, actually. It's it opens up all sorts of arguments about freedom of expression. What, if any, limits should be put on freedom of expression?
Yes.
That sort of stuff. So that one might have to hold
over.
Might
hold that one over. But I haven't talked to you about this before, and I'm interested in your opinion because it's come up recently about weekend penalty rates. And Productivity Commission came out and said Sunday penalty rates should be scaled back to just matching a Saturday penalty rate. And interested in your thoughts, Velvet Glove.
At the risk of offending my better half, I tend to agree with scaling back the Sunday penalty rates for all professions and all jobs back to a common weekend penalty rate. The reason why Sunday used to have a higher penalty rate is because, let's face it, you know, back in the day you'd be either at a church service or a mass service or something like that. Whereas, considering, you know, the contested percentages around religiousness in Australia, it's probably fair to say that even if there are people who do identify as a certain religion, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be turning up to Mass on Sunday morning. So I'm in this day and age, I tend to think that Saturday and Sunday are pretty much the same types of days. So I would be in... Personally, I don't think it's any more offensive to scale those penalty rates back on a Sunday back to a Saturday rate.
Right. See, I...
The flip side of it, the economic argument is an easier argument to make because people who get penalty rates are the lower paid.
Yes.
So if they, they're probably grateful for a shift on a Sunday because they know they'll get more money.
And they're often relying on it for more money.
Absolutely. So maybe the final position should be to drag Saturday penalty rates up and lower Sunday penalty rates to have a average of the two or something like that for the weekend penalty rate.
See, my philosophical viewpoint on this is, okay, people might work Monday to Friday, can't do shopping or whatever, can't get out. I reckon they can do it on a Saturday. And, you know, do we really need to shop on Sundays? And if we can't we pay a bit more? Because I reckon working on a Sunday would just suck. And people need to be paid extra. And if you as a business owner can't charge more on a Sunday and to pay for that extra wage, then close down. I think people need to be prepared to pay extra on Sundays. And if they don't want to, then don't open.
Well, if you're looking at the price of a cup of coffee, what is it? So you buy your takeaway coffee, small size, $3.50. Yep. Even if there was a 10% surcharge on a Sunday, it's still only $3.85. Yep. So I'll at the risk of sounding terribly, terribly old-fashioned here, I don't think it's necessary for us as a nation, for us as a human society, to shop 7 days a week. I think it was... in a way, we've sort of lost something in that once upon a time there was a day that, you know, families could all get together rather than, you know, mum or dad or both having to be off getting a weekend shift.
Look, it can't always be about the economy and GDP and stuff. And I reckon if people have to... We should be encouraging people to enjoy Sundays as families and couples or whatever. And... if people have to work on a Sunday, they should be really well compensated for it, and businesses should be entitled to charge more because of the extra labour they have to pay. And that's something people have to consider. And maybe they'll go, maybe I'll buy my milk and bread on a Saturday and get it all done and dusted rather than hanging over to Sunday. And wouldn't that be good?
The other thing too is, what have we actually achieved by keeping the bloody shops open on a Sunday? We haven't really achieved anything. And I don't think that the actual expenditure would fall because I think people would think to themselves, no, I'll get everything done by 4 p.m. on Saturday, yeah. You know. And so I don't think you've, I don't think the traditional argument from the Chamber of Commerce holds up.
I just think if we lower the wage, then the benefits are just going to go straight into the pockets of Coles and Woolworths, people like that.
Well,
and out of the pockets of, you know, the 19, 20-year-old kids who need it.
Well, even younger, you know, who need it. And so it's, look, I mean, penalty rates, there's an argument on both sides, but for me, at the end of the day, do you really want to attack the wages and conditions of the lowest paid in the country?
Exactly.
Probably the argument is no. Yeah. Probably the right answer is no. And you are dead, right? Because where you've got a duopoly, where you've got Coles and Woolies and no one else, whatever they save from paying their checkout operators, it's not going to be passed on in lower prices. You know, it'll benefit shareholders like me, you know, and that's not entirely right. It's not fair.
So I'm all for maintaining those rates, because I remember this time last year I was in America and in Boston actually, and there were street marches at the time over the minimum wage, and I stopped and talked to some of the people, and basically they were saying that the minimum wage for, you know, McDonald's workers, and these are adults, was $7 an hour. And they were just saying, you cannot survive on one job at $7 an hour. You have to have two jobs. And they were looking for, you know, an increase to $15 an hour. I mean, the sort of increase they wanted and needed wasn't around the edges of, you know, a 10 or 15% pay rise. They needed a 100% pay rise in order to actually get a livable wage. And I'm really concerned that Australia does not follow the American model of treating lower paid workers so badly. We have to go to a more European, Scandinavian model that has a living wage for everybody. Otherwise, we'll end up like America with the dysfunctional communities that they have of haves and have-nots that are no good for anybody.
No, and I'm currently, you know, listeners will be terrified to hear this, but we've got the ability to write material ourselves, and which we will upload on the website one day, but I'm partway through an essay on inequality and the problems that come from that. And so once that's completed, I'll give that to the Fist so that he can edit it for me and get rid of all the typos.
It's a big topic, that one. It's a really important one.
It is a big one.
People need to understand just what's going on in America with inequality. And when you really understand what's going on there, you'll be scared to death and you want to make sure it doesn't happen here. And something like Sunday penalty rates is one of the safeguards against that.
Well, that's one of the safeguards. The other thing is that, you know, as much as occasionally, well, more than occasionally, often critical of the ACTU, the union movement does play a vital role in Australia because, let's face it, employers, left to their own devices, they're not all sweetness and light.
No.
You know, you do need to have someone else that is on the other side saying, hey, no, that's not right. You know, there's certainly an argument around some of the more militant unions, but as a general concept, workers being able to band together and collectively bargain and look after themselves, I think it's a preferable system. And union membership in the United States declined quite a lot to the point that those poor buggers that are wage slaves for Walmart and that sort of stuff aren't represented and they're paid two-thirds of nothing. It's outrageous.
Correct. So anyway, Scott, I reckon that's going to do us for this week. And we encourage our listeners, we've got a website, we've got a Facebook page. If you've got a topic that you want us to cover, by all means, send a suggestion to us and we'll think about it.
More than likely cover it.
No promises. And, you know,
And just before we do actually say a final goodbye, tomorrow being the 13th of August, is a red letter day in that it was the date that the construction started on the Berlin Wall. So for any other history nerds out there like me, it's an interesting
date. There you go. All right. Very good. So, all right, Scott. Well, good on you. Thank you for that. Thank you, listeners.
Thank you. And thanks to
and
the listeners.
We'll catch up with you all next week.
Absolutely. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.